I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Time for Lunch is a new podcast from HRN for curious young eaters, where we focus on the serious questions.
Aren't chickens tiny dinosaurs?
We get to know our favorite foods in unexpected ways.
We just like cheered like you would cheer for your classmate when they're rounding second base in softball. And we just like, peach, 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 peach. Yay, thank you, peaches.
Learn some new recipes and jokes.
What does a boxer's mom put in his lunch? A knuckle sandwich.
And load up on fun facts.
Experts estimate that there are between 1 and 2,000 types of insects eaten around the world.
So roll up your sleeves and dig in. Subscribe to Time for Lunch on your favorite podcast app so that you and your favorite young eater can catch up on the whole first season. New episodes of season 2 out each week.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Kara Warren, and today on the show, I have Matt Benham, head cheesemaker of Arethusa Farm. And for the last 6 years, Matt has been the head cheesemaker of Arethusa in Litchfield, Connecticut, where he and his team have been producing and aging a lineup of 9 different cheeses. Today on the show, we're going to discuss his most recent accolade, the honor of becoming the recipient of the 2020 Daphne Zeffo's Teaching Award. He's the 8th recipient of this, and it includes a $5,500 scholarship and a chance to travel abroad and continue his research, which we are going to discuss a little more today. Matt, welcome to the show. How do you feel about this? This seems incredible.
Yeah, this has been a very, very exciting few weeks for me since I found out. Obviously, this is something that I've been, you know, a topic that I've been excited about for quite some time, and really excited to have this opportunity to sort of see it through, I guess.
So how do they tell you? Is it like an email? Is it a phone call? How does this go down?
I was lucky enough to get a phone call on a Friday afternoon that really, really made my weekend for sure.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Yeah. And how long have you been thinking about this award, or did you apply before? Is this a first time round for you?
So this was a first time application for me, but it's definitely a topic that I've been thinking about for some time. And I think that, you know, it's obviously a topic that I've been interested in for a while. But I think that it really, this idea in particular stemmed out of some conversations that I had in 2018. And since then, both with folks here at Arethusa and some other small producers here in New England, sort of all struggling with better understanding this same very complex topic.
Okay. And would you like to introduce the topic, the subject, in the best way you can? Or I can read what they explained it to me, but I think we should let you go ahead and explain.
Sure, yeah. So I'm really, my project is looking at the impact of animal feed on milk and therefore on the cheese made with that milk, in hopes of sort of better understanding what ruminant diet will sort of lend itself to the highest expression of a given cheese, understanding that that may not be precisely the same diet for every cheese in every context. And I think that we have sort of as an industry broadly accepted the fact that cheese is made, you know, from animals on a diverse pasture diet are likely going to be the most interesting. And by and large, I think that's the case. But I also recognize that that is not necessarily practical for everyone in every farming context. And so my hope is to sort of use this travel in Europe paired with some academic literature, better synthesizing some of the research that's already out there to help folks better understand how they can sort of maximize the potential of their cheese, perhaps by modifying the diet of their herd or the herd that supplies their milk, and hopefully creating the very best cheese possible, and then using sort of an economic component to better understand the return on investment involved in making those modifications, and hopefully understanding from an economic financial standpoint whether that transition makes good economic sense for them and their business.
Excellent. And so do you feel like now a lot of farmers have access to some information that relates to this subject or not at all? Like, I feel like farmers, at least, I mean, I don't know many farmers. I am a Brooklyn girl, but they don't always have all the information and they're going on know-how from previous generations. But are there resources to help them determine these factors already, or is it not available?
There certainly are. And I think that a big part of my research is not so much in creating anything new so much as it is in synthesizing and aggregating a lot of research and a lot of experience that's already been done and is already out there. And so when we began to have conversations here at Arethusa about how we may alter our herd diet so as to benefit the cheese, the final product, what I found was that there was an immense amount of information out there, much of it valuable, but in a lot of really disparate sources. And so sort of trying to tie that together, make it more accessible to the folks that need it, and trying to tease out the most sort of universally useful things from that information is really what I'm hoping to do.
And so you mentioned that different milk makes different cheese. Like, say it's all cow's milk, or is that what you're saying? And then it, depending on what the cows eat, that determines a certain cheese recipe. Is that, I mean, I don't know if I'm mixing things up, but I just want to understand, is it so the diet would change this? And and so you're researching that too a little bit, is what it sounds like, maybe, to find the best return on investment?
Well, I think that my hope is that to recognize that there are a lot of different factors that go into making the perfect milk for a given cheese, and breed being chief among them. Previous DZTA recipients have looked at the impact of heritage breed cattle, have looked at the impact of native microbes and the microbiology of raw milk as sort of opportunities to create really impactful, distinctive cheeses. And so I think that feed is yet another component of that. And so one sort of place where we can look at this probably most clearly is in what we would refer to as like the fatty acid profile of the milk, which is largely determined by a ruminant's diet. And so this biochemical composition of the milk is really what all of those awesome beneficial microbes in the cheese are acting upon as the cheese is ripening. And so they sort of become the substrate, if you will, for the microbes to do cool things and produce all those distinctive flavors that we know and love.
Okay, so a follow-up question to you. A cow is allowed to graze on pasture. It's fresh grass. Mm-hmm. When the grass is dried from the same farm, is it still considered a year-round grass-fed milk?
That's a great question. I believe that it is in most contexts. And now to be clear, I am sort of at the very beginning of this this research process. And so I am sort of preliminarily prepared to answer some of these technical questions. I will say that there are currently some 100% grass-fed certification schemes that have become increasingly popular in the U.S. But I don't know the specifics of all of those.
Okay, so when we do our follow-up episode, we'll get back to those things. So a curious thing then, Matt, let's kind of deep dive back into how did you get into, did you actually, a little further back, let's look at your family history. I'm curious, did you grow up with a dairy background? Was your family in farming? What was your background to this?
Yeah, so I don't have any family in farming. I did grow up in an area that was sort of dotted with dairy farms in southern and central New Hampshire, and sort of appreciate that from an early age as sort of part of the rural landscape, I guess, and recognizing that, you know, that that's an important part of you know, an area that I'm very passionate about. And so I think that, you know, while I don't have a farming background per se, you know, local food and dairy in particular were always of interest to me. And so I actually wound up sort of by happenstance at Slow Foods Biennial Cheese Festival in Bra in 2009. So about 11 years ago now, and really sort of spent 4 days doing a deep dive into some of the great cheeses of the world, and got hooked. And thankfully, it was sort of at a time when I was looking for a career path, and that sort of set me on the path that I've been on ever since.
What was that cheese moment in Bra? Was it tasting a cheese or talking to a cheesemaker?
I don't know that it was any single moment, though. I think that when I had the opportunity to be immersed for, you know, 3-4 days, whatever it is, tasting cheeses like I had never tasted before, and meeting folks and recognizing that, you know, I was meeting a third generation producer of whatever. It was sort of the first time, I think, that I realized that this was sort of a world in which people immerse themselves for their entire lives and certainly for multiple generations. And sort of the complexity of that world was really intriguing to me. And I think I continue to be intrigued by how little I know about it. And I think one of the things that's always what I've loved about cheese is that the more I learn about it, the more I have more to learn. And that has sort of kept my interest for 10 years now.
Excellent. And so then you segued to Beecher's. How did you get to Beecher's then?
Yeah, so I, having no idea how one wound up in the cheese industry, I found myself working behind a small, now defunct shop in Brooklyn called Choice Green, and I spent about 6 months there before making the leap to Beecher's. And initially, when I joined the Beecher's New York team, I was working behind their cheese counter, and I had let them know that whenever the opportunity came to jump into the production side, I was excited to do that. And they said, cool, you know, probably be 6 months or so. And about day 7 or 8, they said, hey, are you that guy who wants to make cheese? And I said, I am, yeah. And they said, cool, suit up and jump in. We need you. So been making cheese ever since.
Wow. And you didn't feel intimidated, or you didn't see the science as something scary. You just took to it.
I wouldn't say that. No, I think that it's been intimidating. You know, it's been intimidating me ever since. And certainly, you know, this project, you know, intimidates me in some ways. There's always a lot to learn. But as I said, I think that that's part of what continues to make it interesting, is the opportunity to dive deeper and learn more.
So, when you graduated to Arethusa Farm in Litchfield, mm-hmm. That seems like was it very different than Beecher's?
It was. So I think, you know, Beecher's is a wonderful place to sort of get your feet wet and learn a lot about cheese making. It was a great sort of crash course. One thing that I was interested in, continue to be interested in, is the maturation, the ripening of cheese. And that was not something that we did much of on the Beecher's team. So the opportunity to move here to Arethusa and make a number of different cheeses of very differing styles, and sort of see them through the entire process from milk to finished ripened cheese was really exciting and continues to be a great joy.
Also, kind of circling back to your topic, the milk quality could also be very different as well in the cheese making process between those two, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that both were fortunate to have, you know, high quality, very clean milk. I think the benefit of working for a farmstead producer like Arethusa is that you have sort of eyes on those cows every day, and you sort of get to, you know, call up our herdsman, our barn manager, and talk over, you know, what cows are eating and how they're being cared for, and really dive into that in a way that I hadn't had an opportunity previously.
And how large is the herd for Arethusa now?
Yeah, so we're milking about 100 cows, give or take, at any given time. And we also have quite a breeding operation. So we actually have more, you know, many more cows than we're milking. And young Arethusa cows sort of wind up all over the country and all over the continent, really. Really, really top quality genetics for Holsteins and Jersey cows.
Is there, I don't know if this is right or not, but is there a lab on Arethusa? Like, is there, when you're saying genetics, that makes me think of a lab. So, but maybe it's just breeding, is what we're talking about here.
It is. Yeah. It's breeding and being very mindful of, how you breed those cows so as to sort of bring out their best qualities, generation after generation. Yeah. So no lab on site. But a lot of thought given to sort of what pairings of genetics may sort of bring out, say, the very best qualities of the Jersey herd in a future generation.
I see. And so now you make how many styles? I believe it was 9 we talked about. Is that still accurate?
That is accurate, yeah. So we're making sort of a very wide variety of styles, about 5 hard cheeses, our Arethusa blue cheese, and then 3 soft cheeses, a small format washed rind and a couple small blue Murin cheeses.
Is that, in terms of production, is that overwhelming? I mean, or it must be difficult to do.
Depending on the season, it can be a lot to balance. And, you know, in the coming months, we sort of have to continue making those hard cheeses such that we have them available year round. But we also need to sort of ramp up soft cheese production, as most producers will be doing in the next couple months, to ensure that we have ample stock for the holiday season. So it can be a lot to juggle, but then we also get a little bit of a lull in the first quarter, as I think everyone in the industry does.
And how do you handle, like with the blue cheese, for example, are you doing production? Is it possible to do production of blue cheese and soft ripened cheese in the same areas? I feel like the blue mold would somehow catch somewhere and you'd be in trouble.
Yeah, so there are sort of some interesting microbial roots around that. But, you know, sort of the primary route is that we have a separate aging facility in an adjacent building. And so while all of our cheeses are produced in the same facility, the blue cheese actually goes off site for aging, whereas the soft ripened cheeses remain at our main building. And so as that blue mold begins to really develop and sporulate, we're not seeing contact with the other younger cheeses.
Good. Safe and sound, those soft ripened bloomy rinds. I love it. Okay, Matt, we're going to take a quick break. Sure. Listeners, this is Matt Benham from Arethusa, and we'll be right back to discuss a few more things. All right. Welcome back, everyone, to Cutting the Curd. Today on the show is Matt Benham. We're here discussing his award from Daphne Zephos and how excellent it is to do research on cheese and move the industry forward through science and academia. I feel like no piece of grass will be left unturned by you, Matt. What sort of research do you expect might happen? Will you be taking blades of grass and putting them under a microscope? I don't even know where you get to start this kind of research.
Sure. Yeah. So thankfully, a lot of that research has already been done. But I am sort of hoping to spend the more experiential portion of this research out in the field with the farmers producing sort of top quality European cheese milk, to understand certainly how they think about managing their pastures, their hay fields, et cetera, and also sort of understanding better the dialogue that they have with the cheese makers that they to whom they provide milk, and sort of what those considerations are, and in the linkage, I guess, between the two. I do, you know, as we talked about before, I have the opportunity to call up my farm manager and sort of discuss ruminant nutrition whenever I like, but I also would sort of like to see the American industry as a whole sort of like better establish that linkage between animals and the cheese room, I guess, because, you know, the ruminant diet is, of course, where sort of the magic of cheese begins in many ways. And I do think that, you know, in terms of the scope of my research, that experiential learning also needs to be sort of paired with a strong foundation in what we already know. And so there is some great academic work, again, sort of a very interdisciplinary nature, related to ruminant nutrition, but also to soil health, plant biology, et cetera. And so right now, well, obviously I won't be able to travel to Europe for the very foreseeable future. I'm working to sort of establish that foundation in some topics that I admittedly know less about.
Okay. And in terms of, so you're maybe still in the planning stages, or it's been hinted, how did you determine the areas of Europe that you were going to study from? So the Jura Valley of Switzerland, I saw was one, and Emilia Romagna of Italy was another. I believe there was a third. But can you speak more to that, how you determined the terroirs that you wanted to really study?
Yeah, so I wanted some things that were certainly of diverse contexts in some ways, and cheeses that, you know, based on sort of my knowledge of them, there has been a fair amount of research, understanding, and importance placed upon the feed systems. And so, you know, the Comté Producers Association, for example, has done an immense amount of research, perhaps. Yeah, and made that available to many, which is, you know, which is very useful. From the, you know, in terms of traveling to Emilia Romagna, I'm really curious. In doing some reading about the production of Parmigiano Reggiano, I found, you know, numerous references to, you know, differences in flavors depending on the precise location of the dairy and the cows, in a cheese that we sort of like imagine in many ways to be a monolith. And I think that, you know, when you talk to mongers, obviously they, you know, they often have a favorite Parmigiano, and, you know, that's with good reason. And so I sort of want to dial that, you know, sort of walk back through that process and understand what creates those differences, obviously with the contention that at least some of that nuance in different Parmigianos is rooted in the farming systems and the diet involved. And then lastly, my hope was and is to visit the Holden family in Wales. I'm a huge fan of their Havid cheese, and have always felt like it's a cheese that is sort of a perfect encapsulation of the place in which it is. So it's both a place that I've been fortunate enough to sort of visit in the past and have really, you know, sort of fallen for in many ways. And obviously it's a cheese that I really love. And so I'm hoping to sort of go back and dig deeper into how that place influences that particular cheese. And I, you know, hope obviously to sort of round out, you know, a trip to the UK by visiting some other sort of like-minded producers, I guess.
Interesting. So from what I hear here is that maybe there's a way to start talking more you know, from a marketing sales perspective, people have mentioned small batch, lot movement, you know, talking about cheeses individually based on their lots.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if your information will help that more. It's always evolving. I feel like it gets, you know, now during this time of the pandemic, I think things are kind of more going in bulk. But I think with your information, there could be added value with the lots and the small batch movement, and, you know, to understand the diet of the cow, maybe having that on the label somehow, you know, this.
Yeah, I think that's a very cool idea.
Do you at Arethusa, I guess you keep a log of all of this all the time, I would imagine. Is that how it works?
We do an immense amount of record keeping. Yeah. So I do think that there's, a great opportunity to sort of pair some records of different sorts together, you know, whether that's combining, some logs about feed and diet more closely with our own tasting notes as we taste cheeses before they head out the door, and drawing some correlations between those things in the long run, I think sort of provide a lot of sort of untapped potential for sure.
And I think I read somewhere that the Arethusa, the word, is flower from Connecticut. Is that also true?
Yeah. So the Arethusa orchid is an old and very rare orchid that was found on the property when the property was first established in the mid 1860s. And so the farm has gone through a number of sort of iterations since then. The current one beginning in 1999, but that Arethusa name does date back to the mid 19th century. And the orchid is still around from what I hear, if you know where to look.
So a cow is not eating an orchid. I assumed it was a small flower that they could somehow digest.
I hope not. They're too rare for that, for sure.
Okay. All right. Okay. Never mind then. I was thinking maybe it's like barley and clover. And it's mixed in with the vegetal life on the Connecticut farms. Yeah. Okay. No, they're not going to eat that. Gotcha. So I guess then in terms of, so you're making a lot of cheese now, but you're also making yogurt, butter. There's an ice cream group that is going in there as well. How do you plan the milk, where it goes to what? There's only so much milk from a herd of 100 cows.
That's true. And, as we've grown, that has become more challenging at times. Our ice cream sales have gone through the roof, particularly in the last few months. I think everyone needs a little bit of comfort in the form of ice cream. So there is some juggling to do there. But, you know, obviously we take a fairly collaborative approach and sort of let our sales dictate where we should siphon our milk supply, I guess.
Also, I can't forget about the eggnog. That's
eggnog
the secret
good.
Thing that I love. Well, not the secret. I love the eggnog. I buy it every year.
Good stuff.
Yeah, you guys make it the real deal. So, so I'm thinking, right now you're going to do some research in the U.S. and then when everything is okay to travel, is that the plan?
That is the plan. Yeah. And I have no answers as to when that's going to be, nor does anyone else, I don't think. So I am keeping my eyes to the New York Times and hoping somebody will tell me when it's safe to go.
Man, Matt, you don't know when we can travel again. That's such a problem. Yeah, no, I hear you. So, do you have? Is there a certain farm that you might reach out to in the U.S. or a professor of some sort in the U.S. that you might give a call to soon?
Yeah, both really. So, I've sort of been fielding some recommendations from other folks in the industry who have. Done research into this topic for their own benefit. And so there are certainly some farms of interest. There are also some academics, the folks that at CDR out in Wisconsin, for example, have been recommended to me as a great resource to dive into the link between feed and melt quality and ultimately cheese chemistry. So there's a fair amount of research out there that I can sort of use as my grounding here in the coming months. And, you know, thankfully, I have the time to do that in some ways, such that when I actually have the opportunity to travel and get out in the field, hopefully I'll be able to ask more insightful and informed questions.
Absolutely. And do you think, how far history-wise do you think you'll be digging back to understand the nature of this? Like, is it going to be within the last 50 years or 30 years or even way, way farther back?
That's a great question. I think that really I'm curious as to, you know, certainly to what folks are doing now and what they have done in fairly recent memory. I do think that a lot of our sort of input intensive agriculture is very much an invention of the 20th century, in which we've sort of placed great emphasis in the dairy industry, especially in this country, on yield over quality, depending on how you define that. Certainly there's incentives built into milk pricing structures for things like cleanliness and for component amount to some degree. But I think we need to sort of delve a little bit deeper and make sure that, you know, for example, those components that are winding up in our milk supply are in fact the ones that we may find to be most useful for whatever cheeses we're making at a given time. And so, you know, I think it's understood but often not discussed that milk, say, from different breeds or from different ruminant diet systems may be most appropriate for different styles of cheese. And so my hope is really to inform folks enough that they could better match their farming system and their farming choices with the cheeses that they hope to make. And again, I don't, you know, assert to be any expert on that yet, but hopefully I can dig enough into the existing literature to help shed some light on that for folks who may have not had an opportunity to do so.
Well, awesome, Matt. I want to say I'm really looking forward to your findings after your travels and your research in the States. I think it'll be a game changer for all of us, because you're right, I don't know if we've ever looked into the differences of milk for different cheeses like that before. So thanks for coming on Cutting the Curd and giving us your future insight. And, you know, it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to the paper.
Thank you, Kara. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show today. This was Cutting the Curd. You can follow us at Cutting the Curd. You can follow Matt at Matt Benham, B-E-N-H-A-M, and myself at Kara Warren. Thanks so much, and eat more cheese.
This episode is brought to you by Root 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Root 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Root 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.